From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
After the bloodiest battle of the entire Afghan war, 8,000 Taliban soldiers surrendered to the Northern Alliance and US Special Forces under guarantee that their lives would be spared. Today, up to 3,000 of those men lie in an unmarked desert grave. And American soldiers stand accused by numerous eyewitnesses of being involved in their disappearance.
Afghan massacre, convoy of death. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Today we break with our regular format of news headlines to bring you this special. In hearing yesterday before the Senate Armed Services Committee, the head of the U.S. Central Command, General John Abizaid, said the U.S. military has investigated 75 cases of abuse of prisoners in Iraq and Afghanistan since late 2002. Abizaid is responsible for U.S. military operations in both countries. He said the Army is still investigating several homicides in Afghanistan that went as far back as December 2002. The issue of the U.S. military's treatment of prisoners in Afghanistan and Iraq has only become a major issue in the U.S. since scores of photos showing U.S. soldiers abusing prisoners at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq were published by U.S. media outlets. But the abuse has been going on from the beginning of the so-called war on terror, even if the corporate media has only picked up on the story in the last few weeks. Today we play a documentary Democracy Now! Premiered in the U.S. a year ago, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, produced and directed by award-winning Irish filmmaker Jamie Durham. The film provides eyewitness testimony that U.S. troops were complicit in the massacre of up to thousands of Taliban prisoners during the Afghan war. According to eyewitnesses, after the siege of Kunduz, some 3,000 prisoners were forced into sealed containers and loaded onto trucks for transport to the Shebrakhan prison. Eyewitnesses say when the prisoners began shouting for air, U.S. allied Afghan soldiers fired directly into the truck, killing many of them. The rest suffered through an appalling road trip lasting up to 4 days, so thirsty they clawed at the skin of their fellow prisoners as they licked perspiration and even drank blood from open wounds. Witnesses say when the trucks arrived and soldiers opened the containers, most of the people inside were dead. They also say U.S. Special Forces redirected the containers carrying the living and dead into the desert and stood by as survivors were shot and buried. Now up to 3,000 bodies lie buried in a mass grave. The film sent shockwaves around the world. It was broadcast on national television in Britain, Germany, Italy, and Australia. It's been screened by the European Parliament. It's outraged human rights groups and international human rights lawyers. They're calling for an investigation into whether U.S. Special Forces are guilty of war crimes. But most Americans have never heard of the film. That's because not one corporate media outlet in the U.S. would touch it. Before Democracy Now! Premiered the film a year ago, it has never been broadcast in this country. Afghan Massacre is produced and directed by Jamie Durham. Durham's worked at the highest levels of television film production for more than two decades. His films have been broadcast on virtually every major channel throughout the world. On average, each of his films are seen in about 35 countries. Before establishing his independent television company, Jamie Durham spent over 7 years at BBC Television. The film was researched by award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi, who was beaten almost to death when he tried to obtain video evidence of U.S. Special Forces' complicity in the slaughter. Two of the witnesses who testified in the film are now dead. Today we bring you again, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
After the bloodiest battle of the entire Afghan war, 8,000 Taliban soldiers surrendered to the Northern Alliance and U.S. Special Forces under guarantee that their lives would be spared. Today, up to 3,000 of those men lie in an unmarked desert grave. And American soldiers stand accused by numerous eyewitnesses of being involved in their disappearance.
think the scale of it, if you talk about thousands of bodies and a cover-up of those bodies, is comparable to thousands of bodies in New York. Now, that is very striking to me, and that's why I think this one will not go away.
Afghan Massacre, the Convoy of Death.
I counted them one by one and handed over 8,000 prisoners. But where are the rest of them? Only 3,015 are left.
Another eyewitness.
I hit the container with bullets to make holes for ventilation. Some of them were killed.
The faces and voices of witnesses to the massacre have been disguised.
I noticed that blood was running from the containers. I saw this horrific scene.
Another eyewitness.
Containers? Oh no, it's not good to mention them.
None of the eyewitnesses appearing in this film have received any payment for their cooperation.
150 to 160 people were dead in each container. The Americans ordered the Shirvagan people to get rid of them before satellite pictures could be taken.
If there are credible allegations from a good number of sources, an investigation should take place.
Yes, absolutely, and I believe that would be the policy of the government of the United States and the military services involved.
Pentagon advisor Richard Perle. All witnesses have agreed to appear at any future international inquiry to provide evidence.
We brought all the prisoners from Shirvagan here to Dasht Lail. All the sick and injured were transferred to my truck. And we brought them to this area we are in now. They took them to different sections, and then they shot them.
Post the 11th of September, the cry has been for truth and justice, and for perpetrators of international crimes to be tracked down and to be prosecuted. And you can't have a double standard where you're saying we'll go to another country and track them down, imprison them, and if they're found guilty, we'll execute them in our courts. But on the other hand, if our boys are involved in it, then they can walk free and go back and live with their neighbours and their families, and in fact, we'll give them total immunity.
During the course of making the film, the producers have been threatened and intimidated. The film's researcher was savagely beaten attempting to obtain video evidence of Afghan soldiers.
What had you seen on the film by then? Early excerpts from this film were shown to the European Parliament. We had received a warning from Afghanistan that the bodies of the murdered prisoners and thus the evidence might be removed. Following pressure from Brussels, the United Nations agreed to monitor the mass graves of Dasht-e-Laili. In the middle of June, when we first revealed a small part of our story about the mass graves here at Dasht-e-Laili, the Pentagon effectively denied that the atrocity had taken place at all. They also denied that American soldiers were anywhere near the vicinity, nor did any American personnel have any knowledge whatsoever of such a thing taking place. We can now reveal that the Pentagon was lying.
Human rights lawyer Andrew McEntee was heavily involved in the establishment of the International Criminal Court and the man responsible for much of the investigation into the disappeared under General Pinochet's rule in Chile.
The Department of Defense, at least the Pentagon, must say what the role was of the Special Forces. It must, for example, say whether or not they had effective command and control over the Afghanis.
Everything was under the control of the American commander. 200 or 300 bodies were put in each container. Then they took them to their final destination and buried them.
The Pentagon has refused many requests over a long period of time to be interviewed for this film. But a spokesman for the State Department has made it clear his government would prefer the focus of any inquiry to be on the actions of Afghan soldiers rather than their own.
Well, we are looking into the circumstances surrounding the events that are reported in recent press coverage.
Philip Reker.
As well as other allegations of human rights abuses and war crimes through our embassy in Kabul. We've stressed and continue to stress to Afghan authorities the importance of investigating allegations of human rights violations and war crimes.
Our story begins in November 2001 in a mountain pass close to the town of Kunduz in northern Afghanistan. Taliban soldiers have come to give themselves up under assurances they will not be harmed. These are the first pictures of their surrender. Within days, over 4,000 will be missing, most of them dead. They were murdered by America's closest Afghan allies. But what was the role of US soldiers themselves in this massacre? Mazar region in northwestern Afghanistan, scene of the most crucial battles of the entire war. Take Mazar, and Kabul will be next.
Robert Fox of the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Why Mazar? The question has existed for 2,000 or even 3,000 years. It's what's called strategic ground. It's where you have to hold this area if you want to get further south. But it also controls the routes east-west. It controls the entry into the whole of the Asian steppe. The Allies, if they knew that they were going to get into Kabul, if they were going to get the Taliban out, they must have and hold Mazar-e-Sharif, and they must have the people who control Mazar-e-Sharif on their side.
The film shows bodies everywhere, buildings destroyed.
The last battle for Mazar-e-Sharif was here at the Sultan Wazir School in the center. 600 Taliban, cut off from those retreating to Kunduz, made a final stand.
They wouldn't surrender, and they even killed the people we sent to negotiate with them. Our soldiers had only one choice, to fight them.
The two major victors in the northwest of the country were rival warlords Mohammad Atta and this man, General Rashid Dostum, widely recognized as the country's most ruthless commander and the man with whom America established its closest links during the war.
They believed, certainly, that Dostum, in the very squeezed timetable that they had after 9/11, could deliver for them, and he was the only one that could deliver and hold Mazar-e-Sharif. I think at that point they had realized there simply wasn't an option in trading him down, in going for a rival, because it would have exposed the rather thin American forces there to great danger as well.
Robert Fox, now Richard
Pearl. In a situation like that, you have to balance out competing interests. Obviously, we would much rather be aligned with Mother Teresa. That wasn't possible in those circumstances. It does lead to a responsibility on our part for trying to help reshape Afghanistan along more humane and democratic lines. And I think that's exactly what we should be doing.
This road goes all the way north to Jalalabad.
As Dostum conducted his battle plans, U.S. Special Forces soldiers were constantly by his side.
He's an extremely violent man with an extremely violent record and with a very personal approach to the meting out of justice and extracting evidence under torture.
You know, when people have friends, they also have enemies. When someone gets well known, some people will say good things, and some will say bad things. If you think I'm a bad person, a hard person, then you don't see me as the people around me see me.
Dostum was the key Northern Alliance figure at the surrender of Kunduz. One of the chief negotiators on the Taliban side was local commander Amir Jan.
A meeting was arranged in Kalai Jangi with General Dostum, Makak and Atta. The Americans were there, along with a few Englishmen. At the meeting, they took a decision that the Afghans accept Mullah Omar. Would be free to go home if they gave up their weapons. And the Al-Qaeda and foreign fighters would hand themselves over under the protection of the United Nations.
But before the final agreement had been signed, 470 mainly foreign Taliban soldiers broke off from the main group surrendering at Kunduz and arrived without warning at Mazar. They claimed to have come to give themselves up, but the Northern Alliance commanders and their American allies were suspicious, fearing an attempted fight back by the enemy. Kalai Jangi, a giant mud brick fort on the outskirts of Mazar, which Dostum made his military headquarters after capturing the city. A section of the main building was made available to American Special Forces and CIA personnel who had arrived to interrogate the prisoners.
These men are dead.
The Taliban were housed in this block before being taken out one by one and made to sit in long lines across the fort interior, their arms tied behind their backs. Chechens, Arabs, Pakistanis, and Uzbeks. Only a few were Afghans. Amongst the prisoners was John Walker Lind, the American Taliban, who attempted to conceal his identity from two CIA officers.
This is Democracy Now! Special Afghan Massacre Convoy of Death, produced and directed by Jamie Duran. When we come back, rare footage of John Walker Lind. Stay with us.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. And the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shall do Allah, Allah. But God, if my daddy could see me now, chains around my feet, he don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes.
John Walker Blues, Steve Earle here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, democracynow.org. In this next segment, you'll hear CIA officer Mike Spam interrogating U.S. Taliban prisoner John Walker Lynn shortly before Spam was killed in the famous prison uprising. Listen closely. It's hard to hear. Lynn is kneeling on the ground with his arms tied behind his back. Two CIA officers are standing right in front of him. The CIA agents say to each other, quote, "The problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die. I mean, if he doesn't want to die here, he's going to die here because we're just going to leave him and he's going to stay in prison for the rest of his life. Short life. It's his decision. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us." We continue with Jamie Duran's Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death.
The problem is he needs to decide if he wants to live or die, and die here. I mean, if he don't want to die here, he's going to die here, because we're just going to leave and they're going to prison the rest of his life. Short life. It's his decision, man. We can only help those guys who want to talk to us. We can only get the Red Cross to help so many guys. If they don't talk to us, we can't.
Just an hour or so after these pictures were taken, one of them, Mike Spam, would be dead following an uprising amongst the prisoners.
Simon Brooks, International
Red
Cross.
Some shots. Some automatic rifle fire coming from this direction over here. Now, I mean, again, you yourself will know in Afghanistan, I mean, automatic rifle fire of a limited nature is not a particularly surprising thing. However, what happened was this continued, and then there was also some loud explosions.
A Northern Alliance soldier says,
"At one point, two of them broke out. They grabbed a weapon from a guard and killed one of our soldiers. Then they grabbed grenades and threw them, killing many more." "We're going to hit them hard. We won't let them survive. They are surrounded by us. There's only one way left for them: fight or be killed."
"The chopper that's coming in wants to land south."
Up to this point, the British had denied that their special forces were operating inside Afghanistan. But the SAS and SBS can clearly be seen leading the attack, while U.S. Air Force personnel call in plane strikes. Researcher Najibullah Qureshi had taken these extraordinary pictures at the height of the battle.
"They came up here on many occasions for a firefight, and the last time I was here was at dusk, and they had another fight and left." "No one seemed bothered. Just one American soldier asked me where I was from, and I replied that I am just an Afghan journalist."
Later that same evening, Qureshi almost lost his own life during a Taliban mortar attack.
"I wanted to go to one of the gates to interview some soldiers. On one side were the Taliban, on the other, our forces. A mortar round hit the Northern Alliance headquarters, and then another one struck 10 or 20 meters from us. 17 of us were blown up, and only three of us survived with injuries."
By the morning of the third day of fighting, every Taliban on the surface of the fort had been killed, many still with their arms tied behind their backs.
I mean, you can see it's an extremely large area here. In fact, it's deceptively large when you're outside. They were spread all around. I mean, you can see behind us over here are the stables. There were many bodies actually inside. They appear to be taking refuge of some description, piled together. You can see small copses here, trees. People obviously, I think, really thinking that maybe if they could hide themselves in there. I mean, it really was extremely disturbing to see the extent of the bodies and the way that they were spread out, and really some of the horrific ways that they must have died in. I mean, the expressions on some of the faces were really, you know, as I say, they were disturbing, I think, for everybody who was associated with that exercise.
That was Red Cross's Simon Brooks.
But what no one knew at the time was that 86 Taliban soldiers had survived in the tunnels below the fort, including John Walker Lind. When they finally surrendered, he and the others were questioned by Afghan soldiers prior to being handed over to the Americans.
My father's name.
Father, no.
Republic.
Huh?
Republic.
Oh.
Are you Republic?
Oh.
America.
America? America?
Yeah.
Where are you from? Hey, where are you from?
Washington, D.C.
Huh? Washington, D.C.?
General Dostum arrived to reassure the prisoners. In front of the television cameras, he told them they would receive the best treatment available.
Don't be scared. No one is going to kill you. We're going to give you to the UN. They can do what they like with you. Tell them that. Are there any wounded?
Dostum puts that question to one of the Taliban, who answers yes. Dostum then responds.
Take them to the hospital immediately.
As for Lind, after interrogation by U.S. personnel, he was transferred to Cuba. Dostum began a mopping up operation, touring local villages demanding that they hand over their weapons and any Taliban they might be hiding.
If you upset me, I'm telling you. No one except God up there and me down here will care about you. You will lose your honor. This is very serious.
General Dostum.
Your village might be looted. Your family will be in danger. They'll be killed. They'll be raped. There will be no safety for them. I'm telling you straight. You must be honest with me. I'm being honest with you here.
By this time, most of the International Press Corps had packed up and gone home. The capture of the American Taliban had been the big story. The fate of the other 7,000-odd prisoners who'd surrendered at Kunduz was not front-page news. Just a few miles away from Calais Jungi lies another huge fortress. Its name, Calais Zaini. The remaining Taliban were taken here before being sent on to a prison further west. But according to official figures, only 3,000 actually made it to that prison alive. And the man who negotiated the surrender claims that many of these are not even amongst the original group he handed over.
Only 3,015 are left, and amongst these 3,015 are local people who were taken just for speaking Pashto. They also took local Pashtun from Balkh, Shebergan, Mamuna, Faryab, and Sarapul. They counted them as Al-Qaeda too. These were not even part of the original 8,000.
In an attempt to explain the missing prisoners, Dostum recently claimed that only between 3 and 4,000 gave themselves up at Kunduz. He was clearly unaware that his own general, in command at Calais Zaini at the time, had already been interviewed by us.
General Abdul Rahmatullah, Northern Alliance.
When the prisoners were captured in the northern Afghan city of Kunduz, they came here to Kalai Zaini. About 7,000 of them came here and we took control of them.
So what happened to the missing thousands? It's known that some hundreds were sold to the security services of their respective countries by the warlords, an Afghan tradition. Uzbeks to the feared SNB and Chechens to the KGB in Russia. Their fate can only be guessed at. The first few thousand to arrive at Kali Zaini were the lucky ones. After final checks to ensure they had no weapons, they were allowed to continue their journey by truck to Sheberhan prison, some 120 kilometers to the west. The jail, built to accommodate just 600 at most, was bursting at the seams. Tell me about physically moving the prisoners from here to Sheberhan. That must have been very difficult.
General Rahmatullah, the Northern Alliance.
We used trucks to transport them. They were surrounded by soldiers. They weren't any buses, so we used lorries for their transportation.
At this point, our researcher interrupts.
What about the containers?
Containers? Oh no, it's not good to mention that.
It's between you and me.
We put some of the prisoners in containers, but we had already made some holes for ventilation. We transported them by container to ensure we didn't lose any of them.
In fact, as the last group sat in swathes across Kali Zaini, rumors of the revolt at Kali Jangi reached Dostum's soldiers. The Taliban had killed many of their comrades, and now revenge was in the air.
General Dostum.
A group of Taliban from Kunduz, Balkh and Chimatil were as those inside Kalai Jangi had planned to take Mazar. Now their plans are smashed. But let me tell you, it was at a high cost. I had 205 injured and 45 killed.
Now there would be little sympathy for the 3,000 Taliban prisoners yet to be transported to the jail at Sheberhan. In a coordinated operation, truck drivers from all over the region had their vehicles commandeered by armed soldiers. Containers were loaded onto the back of the flatbeds and the drivers compelled to take their vehicles to Kalai Zaini.
We were coming in from Mazar when they seized our trucks for free and took us to Kalai Zaini, where there were already a lot of trucks. At about 2 a.m., they loaded our trucks with the prisoners. We were to the north of Kalai Zaini, where we loaded the trucks.
Originally loaded onto trucks at Kunduz, many of these men were crammed 200 to 300 at a time into the backs of sealed containers. After around 20 minutes, the prisoners began crying out for air.
The weather was very hot. They put too many people inside the containers. Many died because there was no air.
Another eyewitness has asked how many containers were at Kali Zaini when he left.
There were about 25 containers. The condition of them was very bad because the prisoners couldn't breathe. So they shot into the containers and some of them were killed.
Another eyewitness.
They told us to stop the trucks and we came down. After that, they shot into the containers. Blood came pouring out of the containers. They were screaming
inside. One Afghan soldier admits that he personally murdered prisoners.
I hit the containers with bullets to make holes for ventilation, and some of them were killed.
You specifically shot holes into the containers. Who gave you those orders?
My commanders ordered me to hit the containers for ventilation, and because of that, some prisoners died.
But this was no humanitarian gesture. Rather than shooting into the roofs of the containers, the soldiers fired at random, killing those nearest the walls. A local taxi driver had called in at a petrol station on the road to Shibarhan.
I smelled something strange and asked the attendant where the smell was coming from. He said, "Look behind you." There were three trucks with containers fixed on them. Blood was running from the containers. My hair stood on end. It was horrific.
Whether or not the prisoners in the containers were ever really destined to reach Shibarhan must be open to question. The jail was full, and those already incarcerated were facing hardships of a different kind at the hands of American soldiers. They were reluctant to talk, particularly when the prison chiefs hovered close by, listening to our conversation. But one Taliban, who had been filmed during the surrender, was more forthcoming when we interviewed him out of earshot of the prison guards.
They were searching for bin Laden and questioning us about Al-Qaeda. They were cruel. They took some of our men to Cuba. And they did a lot of things in here which scared us. The American commandos beat many of us to scare us into talking.
One of the Afghan officers, present at the time, confirms his story.
They cut their hair and beards, mainly the Arab prisoners. Sometimes they chose one for pleasure, took the prisoner outside, beat them, and then returned them to the prison. But sometimes they were never returned, and they disappeared. The prisoner disappeared. I was a witness. They came after 2 or 3 days. They broke some prisoners' necks and were beating others. They were crying, but everyone ignored them.
These things you saw specifically yourself?
Yes.
This is a Democracy Now! Special, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, produced and directed by Jamie Duran. When we come back, what happened to the Afghan researcher who worked on this film? Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with this Democracy Now! Special, Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, produced and directed by Jamie Duran.
But for those prisoners crammed inside the containers, a quick death would have come as a blessing. Some of them remained for days in the desert before reaching Sheberhan. Accounts from survivors talk of licking the sweat off each other's bodies and even biting their fellow captives in a desperate effort to gain fluid in any form. The Pentagon has stated frequently that it knew nothing of the container convoy.
The Americans were in charge.
The interviewer asks, where were they, on the walls or near the gates of the fort?
They were standing at the front gates where the prisoners were. When we got to the Sheberghan prison, there were some Americans and some Afghan soldiers. They wanted to unload the trucks and they were taking charge of the area.
How many American soldiers were there?
About 150 to 160. We didn't count the number.
What were the Americans doing in the prison?
They were there to make sure the prison was secure. There were so many Americans, and they were all armed and wearing their uniforms.
As the containers were opened, the full extent of the carnage became apparent. One soldier, who has since fled from Afghanistan, describes the scene in an interview with a Pakistani newspaper.
I shall never forget the sensation as long as I live. It was the most revolting and most powerful stench you could ever imagine. A mixture of feces, urine, blood, vomit, and rotting flesh. It was a smell to make you forget all other smells you ever experienced in your life.
For 10 days, the Red Cross tried to get access, but were refused. They were told that they couldn't enter because American soldiers were working inside. And this picture, taken at Sheberhan on December 1st, 2001, during the period when the containers were arriving at the prison, confirms their presence. Witnesses speak of US soldiers searching the dead for identification before insisting that the Afghans remove the bodies from the prison. The Pentagon, however, will not comment.
It was particularly important to find any identification on these bodies because they were desperate for intelligence on Al-Qaeda. They had underestimated the strength of Al-Qaeda and its spread. They knew very little about it. So human sensibilities did go out of the window.
That was Robert
The healthy
Fox.
Captives were led into the prison and the dead packed into single containers. But many of the prisoners had not died. Some were so badly wounded, they were thrown back into the containers with the dead. Others were simply unconscious following the journey to Sheberhan. Using a small tourist camera to avoid detection, we traveled to the desert of Dasht-e Laili, just 10 minutes from the prison, with two drivers who agreed to show us where they were ordered to take the containers.
Some of the Taliban were injured, and others were so weak they were unconscious. We brought them to this place, which is called Dasht-e Layl, and they were shot there, there and over there.
Another eyewitness.
They took my truck and loaded a container to Sheberghan and after that to Dasht-e Layl, where they were shot by the soldiers. I made four trips backwards and forwards with the prisoners.
The mounds of sand show clearly where many of the bodies lie. Human bones and a few pieces of clothing with Pakistani labels are all that remain of those buried near the top of the piles.
How many people were you carrying?
About 140 to 150 each time.
Did you bring them here?
Yes.
What was done with these people?
They were brought here and shot.
They were alive?
Some of them were alive. Some of these were injured and the rest were unconscious.
When you brought the prisoners here, were they with you?
Yes, they were.
Here at this spot?
Yes, here.
How many American soldiers were with you?
Lots of them, maybe 30 to 40. They came with us the first two times, but I didn't see them on the last two trips.
If American soldiers were involved in covering up their role at Shebarhan prison, it would border on war crimes. If they stood by as the summary execution of prisoners took place when they could have intervened, this would be positively criminal. But could the United States argue they were not in a responsible position?
They would not have taken orders from Afghans. They would have been in charge of security there, therefore it is an American command, therefore it is ultimately an American responsibility for whatever went on under the eyes of those American soldiers.
That was analyst Robert Fox.
It's quite clear that because you have film evidence of a mass grave, people confessing that the relevant authorities, be they American, Afghani, or international, must carry out an investigation. You have identified the site of a mass grave. You've identified bodies in those graves, and it's quite clear again that pathologists, forensic pathologists, exhuming the bodies, could identify the cause of death, and I think very importantly, could identify who these people are, because their families had a right to know. They have been disappeared involuntarily after being murdered.
Lawyer Andrew McEntee.
Late September 2002. Just over a year after the murder of over 3,000 Americans by Al-Qaeda, human rights expert Andrew McEntee arrives at the scene of another massacre, this time said to involve US special forces.
But I understand from very good sources in international organizations, together with the witnesses, that we're certainly talking at 2,000 upwards here, 2,000 to 2,500 in this area.
Is this from a reliable source, an official source?
Yes, I'm not at liberty to say who, but I can tell you it's a very reliable source, which has not yet gone public.
The grave covers an area well in excess of 1,000 square metres.
Everything I've seen here is consistent with testimonies I've heard and read. There seems to be a large area where there's at least... There are several pits here which clearly have bodies in them, clothing. Bullets are consistent with shootings beside the graves. And there are bullets all over the place, cases of bullets. And somebody's been a bit clumsy in removing the evidence. The Americans couldn't have been kept out of the fact there was a major industrial operation with the excavation going on here and containers coming in, the area closed off for a couple of days. They couldn't have been kept out of that. Having effective command and control does mean they were senior in the chain of command. With knowledge, or presuming they had knowledge of what was going on, yes, they had a responsibility to stop it.
General Dostum has said recently that he would agree to an international investigation. But there's a small problem. He says he can't guarantee the safety of those involved.
We have recently spoken with the local leaders regarding this investigation.
Manuel Gigante, United Nations.
They had made statements that they were prepared to cooperate with an investigation. And what we raised with them is, how about, for instance, security, both for the investigators, but above all for witnesses. And they say that they cannot provide 100% security.
Every one of our witnesses has risked their lives by taking part in this film. These, and many others too frightened to be interviewed, are willing to appear at any future international inquiry if their safety is guaranteed. Surely you should be considering as a priority a witness protection scheme now.
Which you can only do with many other actors. You don't do alone. You said you have been to this country several times. You probably know the risks for those who are here. Therefore, you know it's not a simple endeavor.
Security in northern Afghanistan is a virtually impossible concept to grasp, particularly when you're investigating the very people who hold all the cards. Our local researcher, Najibullah Qureshi, had managed to access damning footage of events at Kali Zaini, Shivar Khan, and Dashti Laili. He had been shown a tape of 1.5 hours in length, which included film of Dostum's soldiers shooting into the containers, American personnel surrounding those same containers as the bodies were dragged off at Shivar Khan, and crucially, pictures of the summary executions at Dashti Laili, with US special forces standing by, doing nothing to intervene. A price was agreed, and Najibullah left Mazar for the handover. We could only wait. As the day wore on, we became concerned.
I had taken a VCR with me to copy the film. I rewound it to the beginning and started making the copy. I only managed to record 1.5 minutes during the time on the film when they were loading the Taliban onto the containers. They were opening and loading them onto containers, and then they started shooting into the containers. Just then, a fat man entered the room. There were three people, one of whom was armed. The person who was giving me the film told me, quote, "This is my brother." His brother swore at him and said he told him not to give the film to anyone. Quote, "Why have you given him the film?" he asked. Then they started beating us. They hit my head a lot at the beginning. After that, I fell unconscious.
Drifting in and out of consciousness, he remembers being driven in a car, his captors apparently planning to dispose of his body.
One of them was saying, quote, "There's a well around here." They stopped the car and took me out. Then another car arrived, but they started beating me again. After that, I don't know what happened. I woke up and I was home.
Although nothing can be certain, it appears that the people in the other car knew Najibullah and managed to save his life, despite his captors giving him a final beating.
There was some very interesting and dangerous footage on the film.
Could this film be General Dostum's insurance policy? Could he be saying, if I get accused of war crimes, then I'll bring down the Americans with me?
What evidence did you see in the film of American involvement?
I saw lots of them at Shivar Khan prison. We can see it on the footage, Americans at Shivar Khan prison. You can see them standing by when they open the containers. There's a lot of footage of them. You can also see a few of them at Dasht Laili.
For 8 days, Najibullah remained under armed guards we provided at a safe house far from Mazar until he was ready to travel.
The winner of the 2002 Rory Peck Award for Hard News is Najibullah Kiroshan.
And after recuperation in London lasting over a month, his bravery was recognized with a major award for work contained in this film.
I wish a safe and prosperous life for all the journalists in the world, without interference in their profession. And also, I would like to dedicate this award to the people of Afghanistan, my lovely country.
But without an independent inquiry into the events in northern Afghanistan, that bravery will have been wasted. The United Nations fears for the safety of its own staff. And the United States will not allow its military personnel to be tried for alleged war crimes abroad. While the Pentagon refused to be interviewed for this program, we did manage to extract some information. In June, Colonel Rick Thomas of Central Command told us they had held an internal inquiry and that they were satisfied that no American personnel had taken part in nor observed any atrocity at Sheberhan or Dasht-e Laili. But in recent days, Colonel Thomas told us there was no inquiry after all, merely a short debriefing of soldiers as they arrived home.
NATO armies have boards of inquiries, and I would be astonished that nothing has happened to the United States about this. It must be looked into.
Robert Fox.
In Kabul, at least, there's a glint of light suggesting that the fledgling administration there is willing to follow a path where the US authorities may fear to tread.
What would the Afghan government's reaction be if these crimes were proved against the forces of General Dostum? What would your government's reaction be?
If investigators find that there is crime, Afghan government exactly follow that in court.
In the courts?
Sir, you're sure? 100%.
You would take General Dostum to court?
Sure.
That was Afghan's Information Minister Taj Mohammad Wardak.
To try its most dangerous warlord in the courts, their chances of success are virtually nil. The Kabul administration has no real influence outside the capital and would need the support of Dostum's greatest ally, America, to launch an investigation. The US authorities, for their part, are desperate to avoid such a scenario, as it would almost certainly result in their own soldiers facing charges of war crimes. One source inside the Pentagon told us, "You have to understand, there are folk in here who would rather this story just went away." But pressure is beginning to grow in Washington.
These are prisoners who gave themselves up,
right?
Were disarmed,
right?
And then shipped out to the desert and murdered.
Yes, no, that would be obviously a very serious concern and not something that we would approve.
This is Richard Pearl.
Would it concern you that American soldiers were standing by watching as they were murdered?
Yes, it would.
Would you believe those were grounds for a major investigation?
Absolutely.
You would like to see that investigation?
Absolutely. If there is credible evidence that Americans were present when prisoners were being executed, that certainly ought to be investigated.
The American command has what is known as the stovepipe in operations. That means war. It goes from top to bottom and bottom to top. So even the Pentagon would have known very, very quickly.
A crime is a crime under American criminal law. There is prima facie evidence. It's building, it's growing. And I think the force of this must lead to the Pentagon, if it's got any sense, coming out with an open inquiry and a proper investigation, including asking itself, has there been a cover-up in the Pentagon as well as in Afghanistan?
Two of the eyewitnesses who appeared in the film have been killed. Others, including many not involved with the program, are currently being arrested, detained, and tortured. Efforts continue to secure the safety of all remaining witnesses to the massacre in northern Afghanistan. You've just watched the film Afghan Massacre, Convoy of Death, produced and directed by Jamie Duran. The award-winning journalist Najibullah Qureshi research this project, and that does it for today's program. democracynow.org is our website. Friday, 12:30, I'll be in Chicago at Borders Books at 150 North State Street, then Brattleboro, Montpelier, and Burlington this weekend. Go to our website, democracynow.org, at Hampshire College, as well as the graduation address, democracynow.org/book. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkadous, Mike Burke on Anagar Elizabeth Press, John Hamilton, Jeremy Scahill. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Tomorrow, we look at questions around 9/11. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Oh,